From New York to Nebraska, Alaska to Florida, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, Congress is considering yet another massive spending bill to deal with COVID-19, but billions in previously approved dollars have yet to be spent. Dr. Joel Zinberg of the Competitive Enterprise Institute is here with details. A new U.S. Supreme Court justice has been confirmed. Will it affect the balance of power on the court? Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Asset forfeiture laws allow the government to take your money before being found guilty. So how then can you afford to hire a lawyer to defend yourself? Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Marie Miller from the Institute for Justice. And President Biden's weakness and predictability has hindered the Ukrainian military in responding to the Russian invasion. But there is a way to correct that, as Colin Hanna explains on this week's American Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. President Joe Biden is pushing for more money to deal with COVID-19. Known as the new COVID-19 Preparedness Act, the spending would require the federal government to borrow billions of dollars, while previously approved funds have yet to be spent. Here with details is Dr. Joel Zinberg. He is a senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute and is director of public health at the American Well-Being Initiative at the Paragon Health Institute. Dr. Zinberg, welcome to American Radio Journal. Doctor, the National COVID-19 Preparedness Plan, as many of us look at the fact that COVID-19 case numbers, hospitalizations, death rates, all plummeting, and we're headed into a season where in the past few years, COVID-19 cases have dropped even further. Is it really necessary to have yet another plan and another spending bill?
It's really not clear that this is the right time for doing this because, as you noted, we're reaching historic lows in the number of cases, hospitalizations, and deaths from COVID. So one has to ask, why do we need this new spending bill now? The administration is claiming that they need this money for therapeutics, for testing, for vaccines, and for vaccine distribution. But it's coming at a time when what's slowly leaking out is that the government hasn't spent the trillions of dollars they've already appropriated for COVID relief. So why are we pushing to get more money now?
Looking back at the bills that have been passed previously, expand on that a bit, because we do have those trillions of dollars that got pushed into the pipeline. And it's my understanding that significant portions of it have not been spent. Is it not more prudent fiscally to repurpose that money as opposed to appropriate new dollars?
Absolutely correct. You know, almost $5 trillion have been appropriated via six different pieces of legislation, three major ones that people know about, and the most recent one being the $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan that the Biden administration enacted in March of 2021. But the fact of the matter is that only about 87% of those monies have been obligated, and that means that the government has committed them, so there's a legal obligation to pay the money. And more importantly, only about 3/4 of the money has been expended. So that leaves about $500 to $600 billion that hasn't been obligated, and a little bit more than $1 trillion that remains unspent. So when you have all that amount of money floating around, why should we be appropriating more money? Let's spend some of that money we've already appropriated for it. Why should we be appropriating more money when we are undergoing record high levels of inflation?
That's another issue, and I'm glad you brought it up. If you look at the inflation rate, the money that's already been appropriated, Joel, has really been, while it's been borrowed and or quote-unquote printed, adding more billions to that, isn't that just going to make inflation even worse than it already is?
Yes, there's a good case to be made that the $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan that the Biden administration enacted was probably unnecessary, or at least did not have to be as large, and that it is in large part responsible for some of this inflation. When you spend that many trillions of dollars and you raise the debt by that much, you're going to have inflation. And this is all inflation that preceded the Ukraine crisis. It's all inflation that preceded the sanctions on Putin and Russia. So this is just not the time to be spending new money. If they want to reallocate some of the old money that they have already appropriated for, that, you know, I can understand that. That makes some sense. And what people have to realize is that very little of the money that has already been appropriated was actually appropriated for the things you would think the government is trying to do, things like drug and therapeutic research and development and procurement, setting up testing and vaccination programs. Now, the lion's share of this stuff went for all kinds of other things. And there have been hundreds of billions of dollars directed to the state and local governments, and they've been spending it for all sorts of other things. So let's take some of that money that and have it go to where it could probably do the most help, which is setting up mechanisms to distribute therapeutics and to give vaccinations.
There is also a proposal that could become part of this that would reinstate tax credits for businesses so that they can provide for paid sick and paid family leave. We already have a shortage of workers in many businesses and industries. Is paying people to stay home, again, another idea that's only going to create more economic hardship overall?
Well, it's an idea whose time never should have come and thankfully has gone, as most of the programs that paid people to stay home have finally expired. You had a number of states that actually went ahead and decided to end them before the federal government ended them. But now we're in a situation where you have rapidly declining numbers of cases. They're overwhelmingly mild. So people who get infected are going to be asymptomatic or have mild cases. In many cases, won't even know that they are ill. If they know, then perhaps they should isolate for a few days, but that's become a very short period of time with new CDC updates and guidance. So as we're trying to struggle to get people back into the labor force and get the economy going again, this certainly doesn't seem like the proper time to restore a program that pays people not to work.
We have been talking with Dr. Joel Zinberg, a senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute and director of public health and the American Well-Being Initiative at the Paragon Health Institute. Where can folks go to read your op-ed on this and other subjects on the web?
The Competitive Enterprise Institute is a free market think tank in Washington, D.C. that deals with encouraging innovation and free markets as the solution to our problems and tries to limit unnecessary government regulations. And Paragon Health Institute is a new institute, think tank, that is devoted to dealing with free market solutions to our health problems and trying to determine what are the true determinants of health, not just more government spending. So you can reach both of those organizations via the website, CEI.org, or there's ParagonInstitute.org.
Dr. Joel Zinberg, Doctor, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
Scott Parkinson is in the nation's capital, where it appears we have a new justice of the Supreme Court of the United States. Scott, good to have you here.
It's great to be back, Loman. Thanks for having me.
A new confirmation has taken place, although the justice won't take a seat for a couple of months yet. So fill us in on the latest.
This week, the United States Senate confirmed Ketanji Brown Jackson to be the next Associate Justice on the Supreme Court. Her confirmation was bipartisan with the support of Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins and Mitt Romney. And the bottom line is, when you've got basically these moderate senators that are joining with the Democrats to vote for confirmation, it creates a political divide here in Washington among the rest of the Republican conference, who were very strongly opposed to this nominee. Mitt Romney actually voted against Judge Jackson when she came before the Senate less than a year ago to be confirmed at the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, and yet he found a lifetime appointment to the Supreme Court more important and voted yes on that one. The only senator to really flip the other way was Lindsey Graham, who opposed the nominee but supported her confirmation at the Circuit Court of Appeals. So it's been sort of an interesting inside baseball thing to watch, right? We know that the Supreme Court balance of power isn't really shifting much, but when you think about the ideology in confirming a nominee to be Associate Justice that really is radical and weak on crime and really somebody that sort of embraces this idea of the administrative state and unelected bureaucrats that are constantly stifling the United States entrepreneur and innovator. You know, I think about the major decisions that are coming down, and when Justice Jackson is writing her opinions, these are going to be political scribes of socialists, of a total radical judge. And when we think back to the history of the Supreme Court, of course, there's been progressives on there before, but we think that this is really setting a new benchmark for how far the left has been willing to go. And obviously, when you talk about every single Democrat voting yes on her confirmation, I think that's a real problem. So obviously, elections matter, and this is why we need to win in 2024 to make sure that the next Associate Justice on the Supreme Court actually is a strict constructionist, a constitutional scholar that believes in the rule of law and doesn't legislate from the bench.
Meanwhile, at that other end of Pennsylvania Avenue, Barack Obama made a return to the White House, his first visit there since leaving the presidency. That had to be an interesting scene, Scott.
It was. So when President Obama comes back to the White House, it reminds me of one thing. Joe Biden is not the leader of the Democratic Party. It's clearly Barack Obama. At this event that they did to sort of tout Obamacare and the Affordable Care Act and ways to expand it even more, Barack Obama was swarmed by United States senators and other guests in the East Room there, and Joe Biden was awkwardly standing by without anybody to talk to. He's looking around, putting his hands up, he looked lost, he turned around, and then at one point he even grabbed Barack Obama by the back of the shoulder to try to pull him out of the scrum, and Obama completely ignored him. And so obviously there was cleanup on aisle 9 coming from the White House advance team and also from Barack Obama's Twitter account, where they post a really nice picture of the two of them together yakking it up in the Oval Office. But I think that it really does show that the enthusiasm behind President Biden is so low. And I know that Democrats just yearn for a time of, you know, only 6 years ago when Barack Obama was still the president, and he was kind of viewed as this cool guy, right? He's so cool, but the bottom line is we know what Barack Obama's policies did to America as well. And it obviously led to a real opportunity with 4 strong years with Donald Trump as president.
And while all this was going on, it appears that there was an actual fox stalking the hen house back on Capitol Hill.
Yeah, so this week there was a fox on Capitol Hill, and it was actually attacking people. And one of the people that it attacked was a congressman, and he got bit in the back of the leg, a Democrat. And so the Capitol Police and sort of like the animal control team that usually just catches squirrels, they tracked down this fox, and they captured it, and they had to euthanize it, and they found out that indeed it did have rabies. And so 9 people are sort of on the watch list and having to go through all the vaccinations for rabies and receive other shots to protect their health. But, you know, when you think about what is a fox doing prowling around Capitol Hill, there's a lot of little animals and creatures that are in the Washington swamp.
Well, we usually are tracking alligators in that swamp, but a fox is a little bit different, certainly noteworthy. Down in North Carolina, there is a very active U.S. Senate race, a primary. Tell us what the latest is out of the Tar Heel State.
Right. So this is a big, big Senate race. It's the biggest one for Club for Growth PAC and Club for Growth Action on the entire cycle. And right now, we just came out with a new poll this week on the heels of a public poll released by Emerson that showed Ted Budd leading Pat McCrory by 16%. The Club for Growth PAC poll administered by WPA Intelligence showed Budd leading McCrory by 13%. And this is all in advance of President Trump's huge rally this weekend with Ted Budd in North Carolina. So we know that the bottom line is Ted Budd is beginning to show a little bit of separation from an unpopular former governor, Pat McCrory, who's already lost twice statewide and is just about ready to lose a third time. We still know that that race could tighten, but we feel very good about the direction that the race is headed, and we're certainly hopeful that Ted Budd will pull it out.
That is, of course, one of the key races that is going to be on our radar screen as we go through the year this year, with the 50-50 U.S. Senate and the balance of power hanging in the balance. We have been talking with Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth. And, Scott, a few words about the club.
Yeah, Club for Growth is based out of Washington, D.C., and we're an organization united in economic liberty, freedom, and opportunity. If anybody wants to check us out, the website is clubforgrowth.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at Club for Growth.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Asset forfeiture cases create a catch-22. The government takes your money before finding you guilty, leaving you without the resources to hire an attorney. To learn more, Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Marie Miller of the Institute for Justice.
Civil asset forfeiture, if you've been following this show for a while, you know all about this, but it's one of the most, I think, pernicious and just downright awful things that happens within the American criminal justice system. And in fact, one of the problems is that it's not really in the criminal justice system. It's a civil procedure, and that means that the money that might be seized, might be forfeited from you if you are just suspected of a crime, is then money that you can't use to go hire an attorney to defend you against that crime that you are suspected of having committed. It's a nasty catch-22 that ensnares lots of Americans every year, and we are going to take a close look at one case where that exact situation happened to someone in Indiana today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is an attorney with the Institute for Justice. She is Marie Miller, and she is one of the attorneys on this case. And of course, IJ does some fantastic work in fighting back against civil asset forfeiture. Always glad to have them here on the show. And Marie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me, Eric.
Before we get into the specifics of this case that you're involved in, Marie, just in case there are people out there who aren't aware of civil asset forfeiture, give us a quick rundown of what this is, how it works.
Sure. Civil forfeiture is a type of case that the government will bring against people to keep their property. And these people do not have to have been charged with or convicted of a crime. The government is supposed to prove that the property they're taking was somehow connected to crime, but oftentimes the government doesn't even have to prove that because the procedures are so onerous for property owners that they can't fight back against the government taking their property. And so most cases are resolved by default without property owners being able to fight back at all. The government just takes their property.
Anyone who knows anything about constitutional law is familiar with the idea that you're innocent until proven guilty. That is not the case when it comes to civil asset forfeiture, because oftentimes property, and that includes money, can be taken even without, as you said, even without somebody having been convicted. Tell us about your client in this case, because this is a situation where somebody, like, they can't really practice. Terry Abbott can't really exercise his constitutional rights now because of this forfeiture case.
That's right. So our client, Terry Abbott, had about $9,000 in cash taken from him when the government searched his house and him. And most of that cash was in his pocket. And the state brought a civil forfeiture case to keep that cash. And unlike most civil forfeiture litigants, Terry decided that he was going to hold the government to its burden to prove that the cash was actually related to crime. And the cash in his pocket, he had evidence, was intended for the purchase of a motorcycle and came from lawful sources of income. And so Terry decided, I'm going to go to court and have the state prove that it gets to keep this cash. The problem was that all of that cash was basically everything that Terry had, so he could not afford an attorney to help him in the case. He initially had an attorney, but couldn't afford to keep him, and then he proceeded representing himself against the state until we got involved in the case recently. But for Terry, the big problem was that he needed legal help, and he couldn't get legal help because the government had seized all his money.
This is a case that has now gone all the way up to the Indiana Supreme Court. And when I say case, what I mean here is this civil question of whether or not the government can keep his money and not allow him to use that money to hire an attorney. This is completely separate from the question, any sort of criminal question about whether or not Terry is innocent or guilty of any crime. We're talking with Marie Miller. She is an attorney with the Institute for Justice. They are a libertarian law firm, a nonprofit law firm that challenges all sorts of government overreach, including issues like civil asset forfeiture, talking about this case in Indiana. Marie, just about a minute or so left here, but I mean, the thing that really boggles my mind about this ruling is that, again, people who are not lawyers, not experts in constitutional law, but if you've watched like an episode of Law and Order, you know the idea that if you can't afford an attorney, one will be provided for you, right? It's right there in the Miranda rights that are read to anybody who's charged with a crime. And in this case, that for some reason doesn't apply just because this weird loophole that the state has found. The state, with all of its resources and all of the public resources that it can bring to bear against the suspected criminal, says, no, you can't use your money to hire an attorney because we've seized it, but also we're not going to give you an attorney either. Like, that, how is this constitutional?
That's exactly right. And it's because civil forfeiture is couched outside of the criminal process. So all of the protections that are afforded within the criminal process don't apply to civil forfeiture. And it's one of the big problems with civil forfeiture, and one of the reasons that the Indiana Supreme Court said it wouldn't be wrong to appoint counsel. The problem, though, is that it also wouldn't be wrong, according to the court, not to appoint counsel or to allow access to the taken funds to hire one's own counsel. There are major due process concerns with this. The Supreme Court didn't directly address those constitutional issues, but they are certainly there, and we hope that the court will someday address them head on.
Yeah, this case now goes back down to the trial court, and Terry Abbott continues to wait to see how he will be able to have an attorney to represent him in this criminal case. At least he's got the folks at IJ representing him. Marie Miller, thank you for your time here, and thank you for your work on the case.
Well, thank you, Eric.
And again, that is Marie Miller. She is an attorney at the Institute for Justice. You can check out more about this case and more about their work in general at IJ.org. They do some phenomenal work on a wide range of topics, everything from school choice to criminal justice reform. And you can check out more of our coverage of those same issues, many of those same issues, at Reason.com. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Bame. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Colin Hanna says President Biden has been weak and predictable in dealing with Russia during that nation's invasion of Ukraine. On this American Radio Journal commentary, he offers some suggestions for undoing the damage.
The element of surprise is a valuable strategic asset in the successful conduct of war. A close corollary is unpredictability. The more predictable one side is in the conduct of war, the easier it is for the other side to mount a successful opposition. Anyone who understands war understands the fundamental truth in both of these precepts. Anyone except President Joe Biden, that is. Vladimir Putin has cagily suggested that Russia's entire arsenal may be employed in his brutal and immoral war against Ukraine. As reported in Forbes, Russian President Vladimir Putin's press secretary would not rule out the possibility of Russia using nuclear weapons. In February, 3 days after Russia first invaded Ukraine, Putin declared he was putting his nuclear forces on special combat readiness, according to the New York Times. In response, President Joe Biden elected not to raise the U.S.'s nuclear alert levels and said Americans should not be concerned about the possibility of nuclear war with Russia. The weekend before the invasion, Putin held visible exercises of Russia's nuclear arsenal, including ballistic missiles and hypersonic systems. The possibility that Russia could use nuclear weapons is not the only option that Russia has refused to take off the table. CNBC reports increasing concerns that Russia could be prepared to use chemical and biological weapons, with Western officials and strategists warning the threat in this regard is credible and serious. The reliably pro-Biden New York Times said that during national security crises, presidents often issue the cryptic warning, that all options are on the table. But Mr. Biden pointedly said that in Ukraine, the military option was not on the table. In other words, while Mr. Putin was putting the most destructive weapons ever devised on the table, Biden was taking his comparable options off the table. Russia wanted the world to know that it should be seen as both powerful and unpredictable. Biden wanted the world to know that U.S. assistance to its ally Ukraine would be limited and predictable. Can't you see Putin's reaction in your mind's eye? Meanwhile, the valiant Ukrainian President Zelensky begged his Western allies and the United Nations for heavy weapons such as anti-aircraft missiles and aircraft. Biden's reaction, once again reflecting weakness, was to deny both. He said providing aircraft or troops to Ukraine would risk irritating Putin, who might then escalate the war. In other words, Biden would be predictable in the face of the unpredictable Putin. Does a single listener to American Radio Journal think that is an intelligent position to take? So what does the U.S. do now? Well, here's a proposal. Biden should draw a clear distinction between offensive military weapon systems and defensive weapon systems. Aircraft can be either, as can ground troops, and to maintain some semblance of rational consistency, he can justify continuing to withhold both from this conflict. But missile systems like the Patriot are inherently defensive. The U.S. should supply as many Patriot systems as needed. The ostensible reason Biden hasn't offered Patriot systems to Ukraine so far is that trained American troops are required to operate the Patriots, and he has said the U.S. would send no troops to Ukraine. But the troops used in operating the Patriots would be engaged in an entirely defensive posture, and thus they are not ground troops in the usual understanding of that term. Therefore, he can use this distinction to reverse himself without appearing to do so, and the Ukrainians would benefit enormously from such a decision. While many of the gruesome atrocities committed by Russian soldiers are the work of their ground troops, most of the physical devastation of cities like Mariupol has come from the skies, either in the form of cruise missiles or bombs from aircraft. The Patriot system would thwart the effectiveness of both. Likewise, once we have agreed to supply Patriots, we should urge the Israeli government to supply some of their Iron Dome missiles along with the necessary support staff. The Iron Dome is similar to the Patriot, but slightly different in that it is designed to bring down lower-flying missiles and aircraft. Once the U.S. has installed Patriots and justified their necessary support staff as inherently defensive, the door is open for the Israelis to follow suit. Biden needs to strengthen his support for Ukraine without appearing to have admitted the foolishness of his earlier policies, and this would provide a way to do just that. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliate, KMGZ-FM in Lawton, Oklahoma. Welcome to our new listeners in the Sooner State. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.